From the ridiculous to the sublime. David Shepard, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has a visiting artist program, which has been very supportive of this enterprise. And David Shepard is the person we're lucky enough to have in our midst this week, thanks to their visiting artist program. We've already seen a number of films from his personal collection, which is at the University of Southern California. We've heard his expertise on several other matters already. It's been a rich part of the dialogue here. But today, David Shepard is going to introduce a compilation reel he's put together of IRPE classroom films, a kind of a pioneering early sound era educational stuff. So please give a very warm welcome this morning to David Shepard.
Well, between the worms and the tuberculosis, I think it's amazing I could get here. I thank Dan for inviting me and, of course, the Academy for sending me. I grew up watching IRPE classroom films in school, and I had such clear memories of them that a couple years ago I decided to see if I could get a hold of some and find out what about them was so memorable. And the results of that are what I'm going to share with you. I call this talk Exploring the Alimentary Canal through gun with Gun and Camera. And means, of course, you're going to have to see some of their film on the Alimentary Canal. But what I meant to say was that IRPE was a company that was exploring unknown territory at the very beginning of sound in motion pictures by trying to produce pedagogical classroom films. Let's start off with IRPE. What's in a name? It is not named after that great 17th century biblical scholar Jedediah IRPE. Rather, IRPE is one of those strange names that comes about like MOS at the beginning of sound film, standing for Electrical Research Products Incorporated, which was the arm of Western Electric set up to exploit its patents. Western Electric was in turn, of course, an arm of the Bell Telephone Company. And among its many patents were those covering both sound on film and sound on disc film, sound on disc motion pictures. After the premiere of the Vitaphone in 1926 and the emergence of all talking pictures in 1928, there was a tremendous mad scramble among theaters for sound equipment, which IRPE actually had not anticipated. So they were busy filling orders like crazy. They had a sales force, but their sales force was mostly devoted to explaining to theaters why there was a delay in getting the equipment rather than trying to drum up customers for it. By March of 1930, however, they had wired about 5,200 theaters. There were still theaters showing silent films. And Western Electric still didn't believe that film was going to convert completely over to sound. And they were looking forward to the saturation point when no more theaters were going to want sound equipment. So the next issue was, well, now who do we sell our sound equipment to next? And one of the obvious answers was schools. Now, this is actually a very forward-looking conception. When you think that in the 1920 census was the very first time that more people were living in communities of 2,500 population or larger in the history of the United States, it was still significantly a rural country. I learned visiting the State Museum here the other day that over 80% of the schools in South Carolina in 1930 were still one-room schools. And 1930 was, of course, the beginning of the Depression. So the idea of selling sound motion picture equipment to schools was really a fairly forward-looking thing. Additionally, this was 3 years before 16-millimeter sound came on the market. So what we're talking about here is a 35-millimeter installation into an academic institution. But IRPE, based on the tremendous success they had had with sound going into theaters, anticipated the same level of demand as in theatrical sales. So they set up an elaborate sales organization for selling sound equipment to schools with branches in five cities. The original plan was to license producing companies to make sound educational films, the same way they had licensed their sound processes to the Hollywood studios. So they presented in 1930 the proposal that non-theatrical licensees should pay them $300,000 a year apiece to make these films, a price at which the producers of educational films decided they would just as soon stay with silent movies. Additionally, IRPI imposed a long list of technical standards that were going to be required before they were willing to license anybody to use their sound process. Finding no takers, they decided to go into the business of producing pedagogical films, and that was their term, themselves, to show what could be done. So now that here's what's in a name. Now, why would anyone care about these films today? Well, essentially, the IRPI films became a template for sound motion pictures as the first modern educational technology. It successfully created a new field. They were produced very much along the lines of John Dewey's educational philosophy toward efficiency in teaching and learning. They were done after considerable research into their curricular relevance. They were done with the requirement that the film enrich in some way what could be done in the classroom by bringing only those components which required motion pictures. And they made certain assumptions of standardization, national standardization, in subject, in language, in competence. They packaged information and text and a learning approach in a way that was starting to be done by radio, by national advertising, by many other things that were happening in this country at the same time, such as the emergence of the automobile and a lot of paved roads. But essentially, they contributed substantially to the breaking down of regionalism and the development of national standards in education. Now, they made the distinction between educational and pedagogical films. Of course, we all know that there had been educational films around since the beginning of cinema. The 28 millimeter gauge was founded on non-theatrical exhibition, and films were culled out of the libraries of theatrical producers that might have some educational value, even if they seemed a little bizarre at times, like the Pathé Scope film, Where Does False Hair Come From? Or the one on how French perfumes are made. And then, of course, there also had been sponsored films since the very beginning of cinema, put out by outfits like Ford, the Bureau of Mines, the Department of Agriculture, various railroads, bureaus of tourism, and furnished free to schools. There had also been a couple of serious attempts at pedagogical films in the silent era, particularly the Yale University Chronicles of America series from 1922 and 23, and Eastman Teaching Films, which was launched with similar motives to IRPI's to get 16 millimeter equipment into schools. And they began production in the beginning of 1927 and were produced through 1931. To a very high technical standard, because the objective was not to make money on the films, but rather to fertilize the world with 16 millimeter projection equipment. And in order to sell the software, some hardware was required. But there was really no precedent for sound pedagogical films. The IRPI people made themselves very visible at teachers' conferences and the like and tried to explain what they were doing. And here in a paragraph, we have their objective. Differentiation is made between sound motion pictures having general educational values and those prepared specifically for use in the classroom. While all films may be educational to some quantitative or qualitative degree, not all films educate or teach curriculum subjects directly or capitalize on the many advantages of the motion picture medium for the presentation of concepts difficult to communicate by other means of thought transmission. Now, their approach to making these is I think, quite interesting. You have to remember that they came out of the telephone company, which had built itself a giant industry founded on research and development. And so there, and there, a great deal of research and development had gone into the development of optical sound and sound on disk. So it's perfectly understandable that they decided that they would approach their pedagogical films the same way. They had a large organization at IRPE, of which the motion picture department was just a small part. They were based in Midtown Manhattan at 250 West 57th Street. They had 700 employees. But when they set up the so-called educational department in January of 1929, they chose as a man to head it a fellow by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Frederick L. Devereux. The Lieutenant Colonel part comes from the fact that he had taken a leave from the telephone company during the First World War, and he was a right-hand man to General Pershing. But he had been with the phone company for 35 years. He was the vice president of the securities division. He had a degree in finance, a degree in law, and a PhD in education, which he had earned in 1917 from Georgetown University. So here was a man who knew the corporation, who knew organization as he had experienced it in the military, and who had some good conception of how of the theories and philosophy of education at the time he was active. So he did what any good military man would do. He organized a committee, went to teachers' college at Columbia University, and he got a man by the name of Nicholas Engelhart, who was a professor and an expert in school administration, who had organized the educational system of 16 states. He got a man by the name of Paul Mort, who was director of the School of Advanced Education at Teachers College. And he got the superintendent of schools from Providence, Rhode Island, who had formerly been the superintendent of schools in the New York suburb where he had lived and where his own children had gone through school, a man by the name of Alexander Stoddard. And these people were to tell him what to do. So they decided that they would make a movie, which was called The First Experimental Demonstration of Educational Talking Pictures. And they got a professor at Columbia University by the name of Harry Kitson to give a lecture, as he might have done to a class. And then they decided to cut away from his lecture wherever they could and fill it in with footage that they acquired from Fox News and Fox Movie Tone. I've never seen this film. I don't know whether it exists, but it was described. The result was not precisely cruel to Dr. Kitson, but it scarcely presented him to advantage. They decided the second attempt, they actually commissioned a production from Movie Tone. Movie Tone and Paramount and Warner Brothers all had industrial film units. They were producing sponsored films for exhibition in theaters until audiences reacted strongly against them, and they got out of it very quickly. But they commissioned Fox to make a film called Our Government at Work, four reels long, in which two schoolboys visit William J. Cooper, the U.S. Commissioner of Education, who for some reason has his door open and is happy to receive them. I haven't seen this one either. It sounds revolting, but it was no more successful than the one with Dr. Kitson. Yeah, I did. I have less film than I had said to. So they decided that they would then continue only if it could be demonstrated that classroom films could be of as much value as the advocates for rapid mass learning claimed. And they built a complete motion picture studio on Bank Street in New York with a wet laboratory, and a man by the name of Howard Stokes from the motion picture unit of the telephone company was put in charge of it and opened up in 1930. And they hired a staff headed by a man named Varney Arnspinger, who had been the superintendent of schools in a place called Drumrite, Oklahoma. Drumrite was an oil boom town with lots of money, and so they had invested heavily in educational experimentation, and Arne Springer was thought to be at the forefront of it. He brought with him a man by the name of James Brill, who had been the head of the fine arts program at the in the community. He was a music teacher, and he became not only a producer at IRPI, but also the sole narrator of IRPI films for all of its released classroom films. Like Lowell Thomas, Brill had a voice that could cut through clattering projectors, terrible acoustics, be intelligible under any circumstances. And anybody who grew up watching these things will have an immediate flashback when they hear Mr. Brill's voice. And over time, of course, they added many other specialists in natural science, educational experimentation, social science, foreign language teaching, elementary education, and so on. And for each film, they also recruited some well-known specialist who is credited on the main title in each instance to give the films, as they said, magnitude and high authority. Now, the films proceeded from a research base with certain assumptions, such as social efficiency being a primary goal in education. And you'll see that in one of the films that I'm going to show you so that I don't have to do much describing of it now. The film covers how research was applied to IRPI's goals. And they also did a lot of utilization research, development of effective teaching procedures with these films, formulating administrative methods for audiovisual instruction, helping to design physical space for the presentation of audiovisual materials, offering workshops at every teacher's conference they could get to, setting up evaluation research programs with quantitative testing so that they could try and prove the value of educational value of talking pictures. And they maintained, as you will see, an extremely high standard of production. One of their objectives was not profit. This was the telephone company, had lots of money, and it was a drop in the bucket to them. So all the testimonials I've found of people who worked at IRPI are speak with one voice, that they had plenty of money to spend. They could afford to learn from any mistakes. No group had ever been seen like this before in educational film, because their resources essentially were bottomless. They tried various approaches besides the two failures I mentioned. They tried story form films. They didn't like them. They failed. And they finally decided to stay with a lecture format and limit themselves to one-reel films, which could be used with introduction, showing, follow-up, re-showing. The films are so dense in content that they urge teachers to show them several times and lead discussions for which they published elaborate story guides. They distributed these films by outright sale at a price, by the way, in the bottom of the Depression, of $50 per reel, which was a fortune, and more than twice as much as the $24 per reel for which the Eastman teaching films were being sold. Now, let me show you a reel of stuff I've put together, and I'll tell you what's on it now, and we'll run the whole reel then without interruption. We begin with a portion of a film called Overcoming Limitations to Learning, which was a film IRPI made to show at teachers' conferences. The first 5 minutes of it talk about the development of the films, how they decided what they were going to make and went at it. And then there's a 12-minute sequence of this same film, which shows excerpts from some of their productions of the early 1930s, mostly the science films. So that with the exception of the next excerpt, which comes from the elementary tract, film which will teach you a lot about the elementary tract at the expense of the lives of many innocent animals. I'll then stay with their social studies films. I have an excerpt from a film called Navajo Children, which was made for elementary schools. And they had a series of children of the world, Irish children, French children, Tibetan children, and you know, typical with their resources, you know, they want to make a film about Tibetan children. Okay, boys, you know, enjoy your trip to Tibet, and off they went. Although they did occasionally acquire some footage from Julian Bryan or from the Percy Smith Secrets of Nature films that were made in England. And then finally, we'll have one complete Erpy film, The Wheat Farmer, from 1938, which seems to be a film made for junior high, middle school level, which I find to be a fascinating film, both for the social values and situations that it encapsulates, and the kind of time capsule that it also is, the idea of a viable family farm, mechanization within the financial reach of a family farm, delineation of the social role of the various family members. And they've chosen a subject which can adequately be simplified to avoid nasty little subjects like migrant labor. They also use humor effectively, which you wouldn't expect to find in these dry, you know, a film which by definition of its lecture format you would think would be dry as dust, but they have a couple of lovely little gags in here. And you'll notice that one of their approaches is repetitive phrasing in narration. Well, it was, you know, good enough for Perry Lorenz, it's good enough for them. And they assume, I think, that it will help people stay with it. So let's now, and these, by the way, are all original prints from the 1930s, and they're shrunken, and James has been warned and thinks they'll be fine, but if there's a problem, it's not him. It's the fact that we're working with 65, 70-year-old prints. We're running quite late, but if there are one or two questions, we can take them. If the house lights come up, I can see. Right now, I can't, so just shout out if you have one, okay?
Where was Erpy based again?
New York. Erpy sold out in 1943 to Encyclopedia Britannica, and they then moved operations to Chicago. Okay, thank you very much.